You're listening to Petri Dish. I'm Bonnie Petri. When folks in the U.S. think about mosquito-borne illnesses they might be at risk for, the list usually begins and ends with the West Nile virus, or maybe a couple of viruses that can cause encephalitis, like St. Louis encephalitis. You may also have heard of Zika, even though there have been no locally transmitted cases in the U.S. in 7 years. But as mosquito season ramps up, the Centers for Disease Control wants doctors to watch out for dengue virus. Kelly Broussard is an epidemiologist who is an expert in how mosquito-borne illnesses spread. She's with the Zoonosis Control Branch of the Texas Department of State Health Services, and she talked with me about the dengue virus, what it is, how you might get it, why the CDC wants docs to watch out for it, and how to protect yourself from it. All right, so Kelly, what can you tell me about dengue?
So dengue virus actually does have some similarities to West Nile in that it's genetically quite a similar virus, but there are some key differences. So dengue is a disease that actually causes tens of thousands of very, very severe illnesses and thousands of deaths worldwide every year. This disease is widespread in terms of endemicity throughout the world, largely in more tropical and subtropical regions. But Texas, we are one of the unfortunate continental states that does have just the right ecological conditions in a little pocket of our state in far south Texas, that in certain parts of the year, all the stars align, the weather, the mosquitoes, the people with dengue to introduce that virus to the local mosquito population. And that poses a unique risk for our state. There are a handful of other states that have this issue, California, Arizona. Florida has hundreds of local cases a year, Hawaii as well, and Puerto Rico, of course, and a lot of the U.S. territories.
In those locations that you mentioned in the continental U.S., the risk of getting dengue from a local mosquito is small, but highest from now until November. And with dengue cases spiking everywhere on the planet, the CDC wants medical professionals to watch for it in people who have traveled to places where it's much more common, including Mexico or the Caribbean. So for folks traveling, how do you get infected?
So it is spread by two particular species of a type of mosquito. We've probably all seen it in our yards. Instead of the little brown guys, which are the ones that cause West Nile, it's the little black and white guys. So they're kind of pretty. They're kind of stripy. They're members of the Aedes genus. So one is Aedes albopictus, one is Aedes aegypti. And these two mosquitoes are responsible for all of the dengue transmission in the world. These mosquitoes are also quite widely distributed in the U.S. But what really has to happen with dengue and any other condition that's vector-borne is the vector, so the mosquito in this case, has to have enough of its population alive, thriving, feeding well, circulating well, which is dependent on weather, the temperature, and the rainfall patterns. These mosquitoes can breed and survive in as little as a teaspoon of water. They can survive in water that is just sitting in a cupped leaf in your yard. So they're really, really good at hanging out and finding a way to survive and breed. And what also has to happen is enough people with the virus have to be walking around in that area. So when you have dengue, even if you don't know you have it, you have no symptoms, which is about 3/4 of people infected don't have any symptoms. You actually have enough virus in your bloodstream. So if the right mosquito bites you, that mosquito now has been infected itself and can go on to infect other people.
All right. So this is kind of gross, but an infected mosquito is kind of like a dirty needle flying around and giving out free dengue injections.
Yeah. So the cycle is person, mosquito, person, mosquito, person, mosquito. And there might be a little bit of interplay with wild animals in the forest, but that's really not a major part of the cycle. It's very urban. It's very human focused.
Let's talk about dengue fever. So when I first learned about it many years ago, I was struck by its nickname.
Breakbone fever.
Yeah, it doesn't sound great.
Yeah, I've never had dengue and I really do not want it. It sounds very not nice. So you can feel like your muscles, but also your bones just really, really ache. It's just a very painful condition. The type of headache people often get is called retroorbital pain. It's basically pain right behind your eyes. So it's really uncomfortable. And it can cause some really severe gastrointestinal effects as well. We have people who just cannot stop vomiting. It can, like I mentioned with the blood, even a non-severe case, what the virus is doing is affecting the way that your blood clots and stays where it's supposed to stay. So you can have mucosal bleeding from places like your gums, your nose. You could have blood in your urine. There's even rectal bleeding. It's a really frightening and intense illness for most people. In fact, almost half of our cases in Texas are hospitalized, at least here in the U.S., where we have a lot of medical resources. That's really reflective of the level of severity of even a minor dengue case in the U.S.
And there can be a rash associated with it.
It can look like what's called petechial rash. So it's sort of a spotty, diffuse. It's usually all over the body. It may not be head to toe. It might be just the trunk or just the limbs. It's typically not an itchy rash. It doesn't have any pustules or anything like that. So it's not at all like the mpox rash that we have to be aware of now that that's another public health concern. So the dengue rash is something that's sort of a diffuse, spotty little pink red pattern all over the skin. And depending on the person's skin tone, that can not always be easy for doctors to notice. So we don't want them to say, oh, there's no rash. It can't be dengue.
Why does the CDC want doctors to keep their eyes open for this virus in particular?
So I really feel that the most important element is, you know, from a medical perspective, we want to keep people safe. We want to keep people from being severely ill. We certainly don't want them to pass away from their illness. And we want them to be aware for future travel if they may be exposed again. You can get dengue up to 4 times. Each subsequent time that you get the virus, you have a much higher chance of being even sicker and of dying. And that is because of a very complicated thing that our bodies, our immune systems, by trying to help us out, they say, oh, I think I've seen that before, but I'm not sure. And so they kind of get confused and they do the wrong thing. And then you end up with a very complicated response to your infection that can make you much sicker. And so, especially for travelers here, we want our providers to be aware that their patient could get very severely ill if they do not keep dengue like on their differential, consider it, and make sure that they're appropriately treating the patients.
How would knowing it's dengue influence treatment?
So like many viral illnesses, dengue cannot be treated explicitly. It's not something you can just get a prescription and get rid of your dengue. But dengue does have a very strong effect on the way that our blood system works. It can make your clotting not work as well. It makes your plasma sort of leak out into your tissues and out of your blood vessels. And those can really, really make your organs very unhappy, as you might expect. Those severe cases are the people where that response, that sort of plasma leakage, has really gotten out of control. They lose sufficient blood volume. Their blood can't do what it needs to do. Their organs start to shut down. And so this is something that even if it's a first-time dengue, or maybe unbeknownst to the person, they've been exposed by, oh, I visited my grandma every year in Mexico. Now this is my first time I've ever been sick, but it might not be their first dengue infection. And they could get very, very ill. So what we want is for providers to really keep in mind that if they see those signs, and CDC has some great resources about clinically, specifically what to look for, both in how the patient describes their illness, how, you know, a rash might look on their skin, but also blood work, things that they would do to, you know, normally check patients out. If they are remotely suspicious of dengue, they should test for it to be sure, but they should also be clinically managing the patient in a way that doesn't make their illness worse. Because what I mentioned about the blood clotting, and it has a very strong effect on the liver as well, is there's a whole category of really, really common pain relievers, like ibuprofen is one of them, and they're called NSAIDs. NSAIDs are actually really not what you want to give a dengue patient. I personally read many a medical record where the patient was kind of sick, but not terrible. And then someone at an ER told them to take ibuprofen around the clock. And then they had severe liver damage and became a severe case. So it's, you know, it's understandable. You want your patients to feel better. You don't want them to be hurting. But if you aren't really keeping in mind that this could be dengue when there's such a high risk worldwide, and you got their travel history and the symptoms make sense, you don't have an alternate explanation, you want to be really careful to manage that patient so that they don't get worse and they don't have like a really bad downturn in symptoms when nobody's being medically monitoring them.
All right. Thank you, Kelly, so much. That is Kelly Broussard, an epidemiologist who is an expert in how mosquito-borne illnesses spread. And thank you for listening. For Petri Dish, I'm Bonnie Petri. Talk to you soon.
Support for Petri Dish is made possible by UT Health San Antonio, committed to transforming the health of the community through a team that tackles problems from every angle, doing everything it takes to bring each patient the best possible outcomes, from teaching tomorrow's healthcare leaders to translating research into new treatments. UT Health San Antonio strives to make lives better. Learn more at everythingittakes.org.
Support for TPR comes from the University of Texas at San Antonio's Brain Health Consortium, a pioneering research hub advancing neuroscience, neuroengineering, precision medicine, and more. Learn more at utsa.edu/bhc.